If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking.
While electoral experts have rated Illinois' 13th congressional district a safe or solid Democratic seat, Republican Joshua Lloyd has other plans. The West Point graduate is planning to unseat one-term incumbent Nikki Budzinski on November 5th. On this episode of Politically Speaking, we chat with Lloyd to learn why he's running in the U.S. House race that represents much of the Metro East. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, an in-depth examination of Missouri and Illinois politics.
The instant we got to Illinois, we joined the Green Party. This was 2000.
So I've tried to push for those that I think are honest and really care about the future of the city.
You know, this wasn't a path that I thought I would choose in 2012 when I was able to win the closest Republican victory in the nation.
If it's something that will help Southern Illinois, I'll work with them on it. If there's something he's doing wrong, then you got to fight him on it.
I believe very strongly in the Second Amendment. I believe less government is better, and I believe local control is better.
I choose to fight for working families and for union members.
Welcome to Politically Speaking. Sitting in for Jason Rosenbaum and the rest of the gang, I'm St. Louis Public Radio's Metro East reporter, Will Bauer. Joining me in studio today, he is the GOP nominee for the 13th Congressional District, which includes a majority of the Metro East.
Good morning. My name is Joshua Lloyd. I'm running for the Illinois 13th U.S. Congressional District. That includes everything from DuPo up to East St. Louis, all the way up to Springfield, over to Champaign-Urbana.
It is a funky district.
It is.
Okay. I first wanted to start off with maybe just some kind of like introduction. Because you're a young guy, how old are you, Joshua?
I am 27.
You're 27, okay. And this is, if I'm not mistaken, your first entry into politics. So many people may not know a lot about you. First off, can you just tell us a little about yourself?
Absolutely. I started my career in the military. I enlisted in 2016 as an infantryman. From there, I got a nomination to West Point. West Point is where I earned my degree in business. Outside of the military, I was a trades and labor advocate, so I went to Washington, D.C. and advocated for Carl D. Perkins Act, which is what helps fund all trade schools nationally. We were successful in that endeavor, and I'm pretty proud of it. But outside of that, I'm just a community volunteer. I've received 3 Presidential Volunteer Service Awards, the highest level being the gold standard.
And a resident of Vernon, Illinois, which is what, about an hour and a half north of here? Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
About 30 minutes south of Springfield.
Okay. Awesome. And so why did you decide to run for Congress?
I decided to run for Congress because when I got out of the military, I was having issues with the Department of Veterans Affairs, the VA. And they always tell you to contact your congressional representative, whether that's Senate or Congress, the House of Representatives. And after numerous phone calls, numerous emails, I just wasn't receiving any information or any feedback back. And so it took 2.5 years to even get my first surgery post-military scheduled. And I was just very frustrated with the entire process, the entire system. Speaking with my wife, we decided that we are young. We don't have financial obligations. We don't have children to take care of at the moment. And now would be the best opportunity in order to fix these issues that I complain about. When it comes down to it, you know, a military background, community volunteer service, that's great and all. But my real first taste in politics was actually with Congressman Mike Bost. In 2014, he ran for U.S. Congress for the first time. And I was fortunate to be part of his campaign staff.
And now you're running. And so there's a number of kind of issues that I want to talk to you about today. And we'll kind of start off with some of the ones that voters across the country have said are the most pressing. And so maybe one of those that's at the top of most people's lists is probably the economy. So, of course, we know inflation has slowed, but prices are still elevated in a lot of ways from post-COVID levels. Housing prices are up, but I want to talk about solutions. So what efforts you know, if you're elected to Congress, would you introduce or maybe support to give some relief in this area?
So the big thing about the national economic policy and how the economic system works is it all comes down to the government spending. The U.S. government is at something like $35 trillion, trillion with a T, right? And there is nothing going through Congress at the moment in order to fix this. They are spending more and more every year, and it's coming to a point where we can't sustain anymore, not even the interest on the national debt. Some of the things that we are looking at are just cutting the costs. So Reagan said it best, we have to cut the fat from the government. But what does that include? There are numerous government bureaucracies that have overlapping mission sets and are looking at the same processes. So we are spending 2-3 times on the same mission, and that's coming out to billions of dollars that we don't need to spend. So let's consolidate some of the government, eliminate some bureaucracies, and bring everything up to a better standard of understanding of where we are going, who's overseeing what process, what are we spending money on, and how does that help the American public, the American people, and that'll cut billions off right there.
Next one I wanted to ask you about is immigration. So there was a bipartisan bill earlier this year that would have reduced border crossings, raised standards for migrants to qualify for asylum. It would have given the president the ability to shut down the border if immigration exceeded particular levels. But it failed in Congress after President Trump had kind of urged congressional allies to pull their support. Would you have supported that bill?
Absolutely not. If you look at the bill, it actually permitted more people than what were coming in at that current moment. So it was just a ploy to say, oh, we're doing something about it. No, you are giving a higher standard than the threshold that we are currently at. So it was even a worse bill in actuality than what they are trying to make it out to be. Look, we have roughly 13,000 illegal immigrants entering the United States every day. There are between 13 and 16 million undocumented immigrants in the United States. Why they are here, we don't know. And that's the big concern. It's not that people are coming to the United States. It's not immigration itself. It's the not understanding of who's coming to the United States and for what purpose.
Third issue on the national level that I wanted to ask you about is abortion. So I suppose locally, Illinois obviously has fairly strong protections for abortion. Missouri, on the other hand, is the opposite in a lot of ways, and there will actually be a ballot question addressing that in Missouri, where we are right now in St. Louis. But some Republicans have suggested Congress should figure out national restrictions. So some have suggested that 15 weeks is the mark. Others have said it's 20 weeks and there should be protections for life of the mother or protections for victims of rape and incest. Where do you kind of fall on that spectrum?
First things first, we have to talk about the mother. I will always guarantee the life of the mother over the life of the child if it comes down to it. When it comes to instances of rape or incest along that line, those are issues that have less than 1% of the abortion cases right now. 92% of abortions right now are elective. That's just individuals who are using abortion as a form of birth control. And that's the main concern, right? Whether you support abortions for rape or incest, that's not the big concern, right? You can make the argument as much as you want. But what Republicans are pushing for is the restriction on the elective abortion just to kill the child, just so an individual does not have to deal with having offspring.
So just to understand you, is there a particular week that you would say is a good fit that you think Congress should take up?
I definitely have my opinion on that. I definitely understand the life starts at conception, right? It takes two individuals coming together and performing an act. And that's where the child starts, right? That's where life starts. Whether you want to say it's a heartbeat or when it becomes sentient, those don't create the life. The life is already there, right? The life is already forming and it's already connected with the mother to create that life.
last up on national issues is one that I think kind of came to be a key difference in the 12th congressional district between the Republican primary between Mike Bost and Darren Bailey, and that was compromise. So Mike Bost belongs to the Main Street Republican Caucus, and he would say, you know, he's willing to compromise to make a deal on a funding bill, for example. But Darren Bailey, who would be a Freedom Caucus member, would say he'd rather stand his ground and not compromise his values. Which philosophy do you kind of fall under and why?
I fall more toward the no compromise. When you compromise, people always take that 1 inch you give them, and they always take the mile, right? And so once you give an inch, they chip away at the wall. They chip away at the stone little by little. Take gun rights, for example. It's not one issue that creates gun restriction. It's the cumulative of every single one of these regulations, FOID cards or no bump stocks, or you can't have certain ammo, or your barrel has to be a certain length. And they can change that overnight. The ATF changes it, and right then and there creates millions of felons in the United States just because the ATF decided to enact a policy that was not approved by Congress. The ATF was not elected by the people. Congress was. So when it comes down to compromise, I am a no-compromise individual, and I think when you set a standard, you have to maintain that standard.
How then, in a divided government, which we've been in for these past 2 years, do you work with just getting things done? Do you get things done in a divided government where the Senate is controlled by Democrats, the House is controlled by Republicans?
It really comes down to the negotiation, right? You can negotiate the policy and still maintain that no compromise stand, right? What provisions of this area of the bill do Democrats want, whereas what area of the other part of the bill maintain the no compromise position of Republicans?
We'll be back after this quick break. I'm here with Joshua Lloyd, the GOP nominee in the 13th Congressional District in Illinois. And we're back on Politically Speaking. I'm here with Joshua Lloyd, the GOP nominee in the 13th Congressional District in Illinois, which includes a majority of the Metro East. We've talked quite a bit about national issues. I wanted to pivot to some local issues. And maybe one of the most pressing in the Metro East this year that has played a big role, I suppose, in the national election is the potential sale of U.S. Steel. So Granite City Works, of course, is owned by U.S. Steel, and the future of that deal is kind of remains unclear. So President Biden, former President Trump, Vice President Harris have all said they would block that nearly $15 billion deal for U.S. Steel to be sold to Nippon Steel, a Japanese company. If you were in their shoes, would you also block that deal?
I would. The job security of the steel workers would be up for debate. Some within Nippon Steel want to offshore these workers and this work, but essentially take on all the clientele and all the manufacturing processes that Granite Steel Works has within the area. But it's a huge concern for a supply chain. Right now, a lot of the United States is acquiring cheap, inferior steel products from China. But it has been shown, especially with the construction of numerous bridges that have collapsed within a year, that this Chinese steel does not stand up to the U.S. quality that we require, right? And the steel, anywhere from $14.1 to $14.9 billion for this sale. Granite City Works employs roughly 1,200 people, right? So all these jobs would be lost. This is millions of dollars lost in our economy just in the local area. But it also loses millions of dollars It also loses millions of dollars for the outside industry, whether it be the logistics or the transportation or the companies that are buying the steel that have to continuously buy more steel because the steel that they're currently buying is not of the quality that they require. And if you look at St. Louis as a whole, right, the U.S. steel industry started in this area back in the early 1900s. this is the foundational groundwork for where U.S. Steel started. And if we lose it here, that's just showing and foreshadowing what the future of the United States will be like.
What would you say to those who would argue it's not in the government's best interest to meddle in a private business dealing, or those who would say Japan is about as good of an ally as the U.S. can have, so therefore what's so bad about it ending up, U.S. Steel ending up owned by a Japanese company?
See, right now Japan's our ally, correct. And we do a lot of trade with Japan. They're one of our largest foreign investors. But it's not necessarily about being an ally. It's about having the economic security here in the United States and ensuring that our supply chain is within a foundational standpoint where we don't have to be worried about foreign markets or foreign production or what's happening in those foreign nations. We have control over our own economy, our own military, and our own diplomacy. And when you offshore, you lose that leverage.
Next topic, your opponent Nikki Budzinski asked the EPA to create a position that would oversee the federal response to Cahokia Heights' ongoing water and water infrastructure issues. So that person is kind of conglomerating all the funding that's been allocated and also what else is out there to potentially help. But the residents in Cahokia Heights are kind of still waiting to see all these big changes, right? Stuff has been promised, but there are still problems that remain. So what else would you, Joshua Lloyd, do to help on this issue?
Yeah, Cahokia Heights has been dealing with their water treatment and their water sewage backflowing into homes, whether it's the bathtub, sink, or any of their homes, right? Their basements can be filled. And it's been going on for decades. But it was just brought to the concern of these politicians back in 2020 when there was a lawsuit that occurred, right? So between the federal government and the state of Illinois, Cahokia has been promised over $49 million in order to help with this issue. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has also gotten involved and has created matching grant contributions to help this issue. But it's just like these politicians do. They promise all this money, all these grants, and then they don't provide, right? So Cahokia has only received $10 million, $9.9 million to be exact, of the funding required. That only gets 35 of their 69 sewage pump plants fixed. They still have numerous miles worth of underground piping that has to be fixed. There are numerous cracks within the current infrastructure. And I believe it was 2020, 2021, J.B. Pritzker signed into law that all the cities and municipalities have to update their water treatment plant and their sewage plants. And it was an unfunded mandate. So he's giving the burden to all of these cities, and that also created a issue where now all this funding is being competed for. So of the $50 million promised to Cahokia, they've only received a fifth, right? There needs to be a better focus on for these individuals. Why did it take 30 years and a lawsuit for this issue to even brought up to these politicians, right? Why are they so disconnected with the community that they don't know this is occurring in an entire city? It's not a small city. It's not like it's only 500 people. You know, this is several thousand people living in this community. And same thing for East St. Louis, right? The city was promised $38 million. The government never provided it for them. These are Americans who have been looking for this help and are not receiving it. We need to focus on everything from Cahokia Heights to East St. Louis to Centerville, right? And it's a shame that we have not put better efforts into helping these communities. So that will be one of my number one priorities, is helping this area.
I wanted to discuss your opponent next. Where do you think she has failed?
On numerous occasions, right? So she failed to acquire $120 million for the Springfield Railroad Project. This is thousands of jobs. This is numerous of years of work that are being put to a standstill. Jobs that aren't being funded. So now these contractors are out of jobs. And this was a bill not only by Nikki Budzinski, but also by Dick Durbin. And they failed to fund this project, right? They had one job. This was a numerous year project. And they did not secure the funds. To make it worse, instead of coming forward and say they failed, they had a press conference. They did not invite any of the unions. And then at that press conference, they threw the unions under the bus, right? The unions did not fail in this, right? Regardless of where you stand on if unions are good or not, they were overseeing this project and they were expecting this funds in order to finish this project, which would spur the local economy, right? There's also East St. Louis, like we just spoke about, Cahokia Heights. But it even goes further than that. She voted against a Secure Our Border bill. She voted against a Safeguard American Voter Eligibility. She voted against a Safeguard American Voter Eligibility Act and the Anti-Surveillance Act, right? So these are core principles that are either within the U.S. Constitution or securing the American vote, to preventing voter fraud from foreign nationals. And, you know, I'm not surprised, especially from an individual who is so tied to the extreme version of the Democratic Party, right? There are definitely good Democrats, right? I'm not saying Democrats are bad. You know, there are very smart Democrats. There are very smart Republicans. It's when you get to the extreme versions of each of the sides, that's when it becomes an issue. And she, unfortunately, is on the very extreme far end of the spectrum. She's been with Joe Biden. She's been with J.B. Pritzker. And she's been with John Podesta. You know, numerous versions of the extreme far left. She was even Hillary Clinton's campaign manager.
So we've chatted about this before. Your opponent does have a lot of money. And I was just looking at the Federal Election Commission's records. And so as of June, the latest data that we can see, she's outraised you 123-1. And money is not everything in politics, but it certainly doesn't hurt. So how are you approaching this campaign, given that the cash situation is the way it is?
So it's easy to throw money at an issue and try to have the money solve the issue. Early on in the campaign, I was doing a lot of drive time. So I was visiting every community. I've spoken with all the police chiefs. I've spoken with as many mayors of each of the cities as I can, trying to figure out what issues are of most concern. Where does the federal government need to be helping? How can the federal government be helping? And if it's even necessary, right? When you throw money at an issue and expect it to solve the problem, you are not actually solving the issue. You are expecting other people's hard-worked, tax-paid finances to solve the issue, right? Why do we need to do that when we can actually solve the issue by understanding the problem and actually getting out there and speaking with the constituents, actually speaking with the community, right? So I've been in East St. Louis quite a bit, right? And no one's talking about how the roads have massive potholes, how they're not funding the infrastructure within the community. And no one is batting an eye at it, because they are acting like if it's not being brought up to their concern, then they don't need to solve the issue. Until it becomes a blemish on their reputation, they will not focus on it, right? So I've spoken with all of these mayors, all these police chiefs, as much of the community as possible. And there is a lot we need to do within the community, especially within the infrastructure aspect of things. Decatur, for example, they are doing a multi-year, multi-million dollar project to beautify the city, right? So it's a lot of aged infrastructure from back in the manufacturing era, when the entire city was dominated by the Industrial Revolution, right? But now all that infrastructure has aged and is falling and collapsing, and the city is taking action to fix it. But the federal government or my opponent has not put any effort into helping. So these are our communities that want the help, can receive the help, but since it's not brought to their attention because they're not going out there and speaking with the community, they're not concerned. They're just concerned about the next election. So I'm not concerned at all with the finances because I'm actually out there talking with individuals. And this is not a necessarily a money game, right? People always say it's about the money. No, it's about being analytical, understanding where to put your effort.
Why should voters in the 13th Congressional District support you in November?
I think it's clear that I'm an individual who has put my entire life for helping the community, whether it's the 3 Presidential Volunteer Service Awards, which in order to receive one, you have to put forth over 250 hours of community volunteer service hours. So that's numerous hours I'm putting forward to the community. I dedicated my life within the military. I was willing to sacrifice for the better good of the community, for the better good of the nation. And when it comes down to it, my background is within the economic spectrum, right? I studied business. I understand how it works, how money operates, and how to better the economy.
Well, those are all the questions I have for you. So thank you for joining us. Politically Speaking is a product of St. Louis Public Radio, a listener-supported service of the University of Missouri-St. Louis. You can read all of our coverage of Illinois and Missouri politics at stlpr.org. And Joshua, where can people learn more about your campaign?
If you would like to learn more, please visit lloydforcongress.com. That is lloydforcongress.com. Individuals can also send me a message directly to my phone at 618-417-7336.
The personal phone number.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Well, thank you for the time, Joshua, and good luck in November.
Thank you.
Politically Speaking is produced by Sarah Kellogg, Rachel Lipman, and me, Jason Rosenbaum. The show is edited by Fred Ehrlich. Read all of our coverage at stlpr.org. And if you haven't already, make sure to subscribe to Politically Speaking by searching the term Politically Speaking on Apple Podcasts. From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.